Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilo Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilo. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about pediatric cancer survivorship with Dr. Nina Caden-Lodick. Dr. Caden-Lodick is Associate Professor of Pediatrics in Hematology Oncology and Medical Director of the HEROES Clinic at the Yale School of Medicine. Here's Dr. Stephen Gore.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and what kind of cancers you take care of.
Well, I wear a couple of different hats at the Yale Cancer Center. I have two passions. My first is cancer survivorship in children and adults. And this started because I was realizing as the survival rates increase in individuals under the age of 21 with cancer, it's now over 80% overall, that we have this growing population of survivors, and we need to give them what the next step is and take care of them.
Are you saying that over 80% of children with cancer are cured now?
They are, and it's higher and higher each year. It's inching up. It's always highlighted as one of our modern medical miracles. It happened in my lifetime, and you can't see me on the radio, but I'm not too old. And so,
I'll vouch for that.
Okay, so it's amazing, and it's happened very rapidly in the recent decades, almost more rapidly than we realized how to take care of this growing population, because now we have kids who were never expected to grow up, who we now want to succeed in school, grow up and feel good, have energy to live active lives every day, grow up and have their own children, be fertile enough to have their own children. And so my academic research interest is in understanding how to reduce late effects from cancer treatment in these survivors and how to help these individuals live the fullest lives as they grow up. And that's why I started the HEROES Clinic at Yale.
Great. Well, we're going to really want to talk, obviously, a lot about survivorship in the HEROES Clinic. But just to go back to this incredible cure rate, which is so exciting to hear about, I think many of us are familiar either because we read the news, or many people have read the book whose name is escaping me. That's a biography of cancer. It's going to drive me crazy. But
The one from the Harvard author. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
History of Cancer.
No. We'll come up with
it. I know what you mean.
Yeah. Well, he really focuses on childhood acute lymphoblastic leukemia,
yes,
or what we think of as childhood leukemia, as sort of what started the whole success. So. But obviously, that can't account, the high success rate in childhood leukemia can't account for that whole 80%, right?
No, I'm talking about all comers. So in leukemia, it's well over 90%. And for the most common type of leukemia, it's 97%.
Wow.
So it's really high. And that goes to the other hat I wear and my other passion. The reason it's so high, or one of the important reasons, is that we pediatric oncologists work very closely together. And for the last 3 or 4 decades, we have had a research consortium. Yale is an important member of this consortium, in which we work together, meet twice a year, and have exciting research trials with the newest and best ideas. And we enroll our children on them, and we put aside our egos, doesn't matter where you're from, and we all enroll our children on them. And in that way, we have participation rates of over 80% of children going on a research trial. So instead of just getting what we did 5 years ago or 10 years ago, we're always able to offer children the most up-to-date, cutting-edge therapeutic options.
Wow. I just remember the name of the book is The Emperor of All Maladies.
Yes, that sounds familiar. And I have read it, so I'm embarrassed.
It's a wonderful book for anybody in the audience who's interested in learning the history of the modern anti-cancer movement and a lot about the early days of the struggles to cure childhood leukemia. It reads like an adventure story, really.
And it is really exciting, and I'm always freaked out because I was born in the late 60s, almost 1970, and I am always struck that if I had had childhood ALL, which I just told you is almost 100% curable, I wouldn't likely, Dr. Gore, not be here with you today. That's how fast it's been.
No, and I remember as a kid in school, you know, there would be a kid who would show up, you know, then we would know would stop going to school, and we'd hear, oh, that he had leukemia, and you know, and you'd ask your mom or dad what that was about. Well, it's a cancer, and the likelihood was they were going to die. This is in the 60s.
And now we start talking to them, and we're doing research studies about incorporating physical activity during treatment and working on school interventions, already planning for when they're done with therapy. We start doing that during therapy because we want them to be ready to reenter life.
Wow, that's so neat. So what is survivorship exactly as a field or even as a term? It's not a term that I would use kind of, you know, with my family or friends.
Well, I think it's used in different ways. The National Cancer Institute would define it as anyone diagnosed with cancer who's been affected by it, who's alive now. So it could be someone just diagnosed yesterday, someone diagnosed 10 years ago. Hmm. And it could be a family member who had to help care for someone or support someone. When I talk about it with you, I'm thinking of it more as the after treatment period, because we have different strategies for keeping people well and giving the best care during therapy and managing acute symptoms and making the best therapeutic decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think of survivorship in terms of how to optimize quality of life, physical health, minimizing side effects of therapy after the therapy ends. So I think that's the way that most of us who are doing survivorship research think of it. And sometimes it means an intervention during therapy, as I just talked about. For example, we are studying one of the research studies that I'm involved with, that we're hoping will soon be a national multi-site study, is having our patients do more physical activity during treatment with the hope that they will be stronger and more vigorous and have less neuropathy and bone problems and heart problems later in life as they grow up over those decades.
So I would have thought that, you know, if I were cured of a child cancer, like the last place I'd want to go back to is see an oncologist.
That is true. And for some people, in pediatric oncology, it's a little different than in adult oncology because we're pediatricians. And
you've got those little fuzzy animals on your stethoscope,
Well, we do that and we don't wear white coats, but we also are always thinking ahead developmentally. We are always thinking ahead 10 years from now because we know we care for our kids through many different developmental stages and ages. So it's very common for our patients to stay connected with us more than 5 years, 10 years after therapy. And for survivorship, some of the problems can emerge occur right away in the first few years, and others, like having problems with fertility, may not become apparent until the child becomes a young adult and seeks to get married and have children. And so in our Hero Survivorship Clinic, we don't have an upper age range. We see all individuals who were diagnosed under the age of 21. And I actually think my oldest patient is almost 60 and is a grandmother. She's a Hodgkin survivor and does quite well.
60 years old.
And she's amazing.
She's a hero.
She is a hero. And that's why we named it Heroes Clinic. We think of our patients very much as heroes, and we think of their family members as heroes. And we wanted that name because it reminds us every day how amazing our patients are.
Is HEROES an acronym for something, or is it just a great name.
So we started with the hero, and then we went backwards and made it work because we wanted the word hero.
Right.
So we made it stand for Health Education Research Outcomes in Survivors, but the secret is that it started off with heroes because that was what came to mind when we thought about our survivorship clinic.
How long has this clinic been in existence?
So I was recruited to Yale in 2003 to start this clinic. So it's been a little over 10 years, and it's been when we first started, we were one of the first in the country. Mm. We were the first in Connecticut, and then we're one of the first few in the country. When I was doing my fellowship in pediatric oncology, I happened to have several kids who had fractures at the end of therapy and in the beginning of off therapy, and I started trying to figure out why and studied bone mineral density changes from steroids and methotrexate. And so I did my research in that area during fellowship, and then I sought out a postdoctoral fellowship, and I did a postdoc fellowship in survivorship research.
Hmm.
At Minnesota, which had a large cohort of 12,000 survivors they were following.
Well, it's a big pediatric transplant program, isn't it?
It's a big transplant program, but also I'm an investigator in the Childhood Cancer Survivor Study. My mentor is Dr. Les Robison is the PI of that. It's kind of like the Framingham study. There are 12,000 childhood cancer survivors that are being followed every 2 years.
Wow.
To see how they're doing. And their oldest patients now are in their early 50s. So we have learned a lot from that group as well. And a lot of publications that inform how we can take care of them best are from that group. We are contributing to that literature, too, with patients that come to our Heroes Clinic. I really think of the Heroes as a living laboratory. First and foremost, we take care of our patients and do what they need. But I want to feel that every year that they come to us, we'll have something new to offer. And we want to keep on learning. We don't want to just document what the problems are, but we want to understand how to prevent them and how to make things better. So that's why we do intervention studies on improving neurocognitive outcomes and physical outcomes. Try to teach the patients what to watch for so that they can identify issues before it becomes a problem while we can still fix it.
Hmm. So if I'm a survivor of a cancer, which presented before I was age 21, I guess you said, and I were to come to the Heroes Clinic, what would I expect there? I mean, is it classroom? Is there a doctor's exam? What's going on?
So it's a little bit of everything. It's a multidisciplinary clinic. And what would happen first is that we do a really good interview with the patient and figure out what worries the patient has, if they're already adults, if they're younger, what worries their parents may have. And then we ask our own questions, screening for problems that we know that people who were treated with their particular protocols could have. We've done a lot of work before they even came. We spend a few hours and actually summarize all the treatments they received, calculate total doses of chemotherapy, radiation, types of surgery, so we know what questions to ask and mm-hmm. know what we'd be thinking about. We do a very thorough exam. We order and arrange all the tests and evaluations that would be recommended according to those individualized exposures. So every patient will have a different experience depending on what treatments they had. So for example, if a child or a young adult had anthracyclines mm-hmm. or chemo, they would get an echo. If they had a certain drug, we would check to see if they're going through puberty well with hormone tests. And then we have a nurse educator who teaches them what to watch out for and a neuropsychologist who screens for cognitive problems.
Okay, well, we're going to pick up on that after the break. But right now, it's time to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about pediatric cancer survivorship with Dr. Nina Caden-Lodick.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2014, over 1,500 people would be diagnosed with colorectal cancer in Connecticut and nearly 150,000 nationwide. When detected early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable, and as a result, it's recommended that men and women over the age of 50 have regular colonoscopies to screen for the disease. Patients with colorectal cancer have more hope than ever before due to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale and at Smilow Cancer Hospital, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Tumor gene analysis has helped improve management of the disease by identifying the patients most likely to benefit from chemotherapy and newer targeted agents, resulting in more patient-specific treatments. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Nina Caden-Lodick. We are discussing pediatric cancer survivorship. Nina, before the break, you were telling us about the experience that a survivor of childhood cancer gets when they come into your Heroes Survivorship Clinic. And you mentioned that you've spent a lot of time figuring out sort of the various doses of drugs they've gotten and radiation and what kind of side effects to expect. And then you ask them questions and you do some screening tests. And I know one of the things you were talking about had to do with some kind of chemotherapy that seemed to affect the heart as one example. So maybe you could just pick up and so you've got the patient there, you know what kind of treatment they've had, and you know you've asked the parents or the patient what their anxieties or concerns are. Then what happens?
So then we do screening tests according to what the patient's that particular patient had, because of course cure is the initial goal, but very often the therapies needed to cure a child can result in late effects. And some examples include heart failure from radiation to the chest, or a type of chemotherapy called anthracycline. One can get renal insufficiency. That's a kidney problem from cisplatinum. You can also get hearing problems. You can get hormone problems so that you have trouble going through puberty or need help with growth hormone to grow properly. You can get second cancers, unfortunately. Some of the chemo and radiation also cause an increased risk of subsequent cancers. It doesn't mean you're automatically going to get it, but you have some of our patients have a higher risk compared to other people their age and gender who didn't have that cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so the good news, this sounds really scary, I know.
Yeah.
It is scary. And our studies show that about 2/3 of survivors will have at least one problem that needs medical intervention.
But not necessarily cancer.
Not necessarily cancer. So the increased risk of cancer is in certain groups, and it still means that most likely most people won't get cancer. It's just increased risk compared to others.
Okie doke.
But because there's an increased risk, we want to give them extra attention and hopefully prevent these problems. So even though a lot of patients will, 2/3 could get a late effect, most of them, most of these problems really respond well to early detection, such that you can prevent the problem from happening. And that's the case, for example, in cancer. Breast cancer is increased in girls who have had radiation to the chest. But we know to start mammograms early. So these girls start mammograms at age 25. Another example is there's a kind of cancer that can occur in the bladder, and we know to screen these survivors with urine analyses looking for blood. So we can catch things before they're an issue. And we've actually caught several breast cancers in our clinic in very young women before it was clinically apparent in any way or even to my exam. So that's important. I think of my clinic as a very positive clinic, because most of the time we we are able to really improve people's health, give them the knowledge they need to know what to watch for, and we can do this. We call it a super checkup for keeping people healthy. And we have a great team. It also includes Dr. Balsamo, who's a neuropsychologist who screens for cognitive and learning issues after chemotherapy and can help people, kids as students and as college kids and even adults help get help to think to function at their best. We also, and she also supports people who are suffering with stress or with anxiety because of their past diagnosis. And we have Jamie Rotatori, who's a nurse educator, who explains how to eat more healthy, to maximize fruits and vegetables, which can halve your risk of cancer, 5 fruits and vegetables a day. I think you must have talked about this on your radio show. But it's something simple that we really want our kids especially to do.
You're saying fruits increase the risk of cancer or decrease the risk of cancer?
Oh, whoops, did I misspeak? Decrease, well, decrease. So okay. Halve your risk
halve.
Of cancer.
Halve, I just want,
yes.
Right, I
yeah,
got
decrease.
It. Divide
makes
in
it half, divide in half.
Have,
but it has to be 5, 3 isn't enough. And 7 is better than 5. But
that's a lot of fruit.
Well, one serving of fruit is half a cup and a serving of vegetables is 1 cup. But it's been – this is such good data, and I'm a researcher. It's so strong. It's been shown in the U.S. It's been shown in Canada. It's been reproduced. It's not like some of these days you hear about, like, eat lots of lima beans.
And I then, like lima beans.
And then next week it's like eat lots of whatever is grapes. You know, this one has been reproduced. But you do need to eat a variety, and it has to be frozen or fresh or whole juiced. It can't be the processed juice. That hasn't shown the same benefit. Anyway, we talk about that. We talk about physical activity. We talk about how to do self-exam, testicular and breast self-exams, because these are young people, and they may feel shy about this, or they may not get this in normal non-cancer checkups. And so we talk about that. And then Jamie spends a lot of time explaining to the patients or survivorship care plan, basically what their treatments were, and then the detailed list of what checkup tests they need and evaluations they need in the future, so that even if they move or go off to college or whatever, that they have that document that they can take to any doctor that says, this is what my checkup should look like. And, of course, we also send a copy of this to all the survivors' doctors and anyone else they want to have it.
And do the patients, if they stay locally, continue to follow with you? Or is this kind of a one-time assessment and then they go back to their primary care physician?
We leave it up to the patients. Most of them do stay with us yearly unless they move away. But for some, we have patients from parts of New York and Massachusetts and Rhode Island as well. And if they're coming farther, sometimes they can't come yearly, and they take that information back. Or even sometimes they just have a very close relationship with their primary care doctor and want, as most people should actually, which I really encourage. That's one of the most important interventions we do, is make sure that we help people find primary care doctors who don't have one. But some of them don't want to come back to the cancer center, which is what you mentioned earlier. Sometimes just the
traumatic, right?
It's traumatic. It's traumatic to be in that same
environment.
And so we give them the information they need, because the types of tests that are needed are not ones that need to be done in a cancer center.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the doc needs the knowledge to do them, know that this is what this particular person needs.
Gotcha. And can you be in the Heroes Clinic if you haven't been treated at Yale?
Yes, absolutely. We welcome any patients. The only thing is that we ask for patients that are diagnosed under the age of 21, because there are certain therapies that are given in that age group and certain issues that arise more as those people are growing up, and that's where our expertise is. And I'm sure you're going to have Dr. Sanft on another time, but she's the expert of survivors of adult cancers, and so there's also an adult survivor clinic for those patients.
Oh, that's great. I know that at least some years ago, there was a lot of interest at least in pediatric leukemia, in trying to dial back the intensity of the treatment for certain easier-to-cure cancers. Is that something that's continued, and is that something that sort of survivorship experts like you interface with the people designing the studies to see if you see there's a lot of, late effects on the heart or whatever? How does that work?
And I mentioned that I have another passion, and that's clinical trials. So I'm one of the members of the National Children's Oncology Group Leukemia Committee, ALL, this specific type that you talked about. And our last trial is actually a dose reduction question. It's to see if we can give less steroids and less vincristin so that we can have less problems later with bone health and less problems with neuropathy. And that's very exciting. There are other diseases that we've been really successful in doing that. We had a recent trial in Hodgkin lymphoma in which we studied sparing radiation and using therapies that are less likely to cause infertility later. And it was a win. We found that we could preserve those high cure rates and still give the survivors a better future. The ALL study is still ongoing, the one that's looking at the less steroids and vincristin, but it's very exciting for me that we were at a point we could look at that.
Yeah. Do you find that it's hard to enroll patients in trials like that because it seems so scary to be getting less therapy than what you know works?
Well, I think that it's not... I think it's more a matter of explaining it to patients and talking about it. These ideas don't come totally out of a vacuum. They're not just thought experiments. There's preliminary data or pilot data, safety data in smaller groups of patients that showed that it works. So the larger studies are to prove it with absolute statistical significance. So... that's one thing. And then the second thing is that I think that it's really a team effort taking care of patients. And a very important part of the team is the patient and their family. And I think it's very important to talk frankly about risks and benefits because, unfortunately, I think we know this in life in general. Nothing comes totally for free. There's always some risks. And I think that even in someone who's not on a protocol, if we have a young person, like an older teenager, who fertility is very important and is an important life value and family value, and that person is making an informed decision, I think that it's important to talk about options and talk about other protocols that are available that could help that person have a risk-benefit ratio that's more comfortable for that individual. So I think it can be hard and it can be scary, but I think it's about explaining things and being frank. And certainly with late effects, I think that if families understand that we expect the child to live, thankfully, that we also want them to live well, I think they'll also be able to understand that. But then they'll have to make their own decision according to what they're comfortable with.
At what age do kids get to have a say in this? Obviously you've got the parents, you got the kids, but it's about the kids. But what age can they understand enough? And
so,
I'm sure it's different from family to family, I imagine.
So it is different. Our ethics board requires parental consent for everyone under 18. I'm sorry, yes, under 18. But we would talk with every child separate from the written consent about the general idea, responding to where they are in their developmental stage. We would bring them into the discussion. A younger child, we may just say, you're sick and you have to stay in the hospital and we think we have a new medicine for you that will work and your parents are okay with it. We want to tell you it's happening. An older teenager, we would explain the randomization or the different options better and encourage them to talk with their parents and decide together.
Dr. Nina Caden-Lodick is Associate Professor of Pediatrics in Hematology Oncology and Medical Director of the HEROES Clinic at the Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, as well as Renee Gaudet, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers right here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.